Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Robert Cangelosi, Jr., author of New Orleans Architecture Volume 9, Carrollton, and Jason Strada, Executive Director of Friends of the Cabildo. We'll also hear from Chris Champagne, author of The Most Interesting League in the World, How the NFL Explains America. Robert Cangelosi, Jr. is president and partner at Koch & Wilson Architects, one of New Orleans' oldest and most distinguished architectural firms, and a member of the American Institute of Architects. Today, we're talking about his new book, the most recent in the beloved New Orleans architecture series, Volume 9, Carrollton, which features photos by Neil Alexander. Robbie was also the editor for the previous two volumes, Jefferson City and University Sections. He's now at work on the Vue Carré volume, another one to look forward to. Every new addition to this series is an event, and this one is no exception. Jason Strada, Executive Director of the Friends of the Cabildo, will join us later. Robbie Cangelosi, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
You've been working on this series for such a long time, and as a volunteer.
Yes, the entire series has been done by volunteers. Only the photographers have been paid. So all the proceeds we do not receive, it all goes to the Friends of the Cabildo in support of the Louisiana State Museum.
Giving new meaning to the words labor of love, I must say.
Definitely.
Whoa. But what a rich and interesting history Carrollton has. It started off as part of Jefferson Parish, then was annexed into New Orleans, and you document more than 1,000 structures in this book.
That's correct. There's not a whole lot in the book from the 19th century. There's only a handful from the 19th century. Most of them are from the 20th century because although Carrollton is first subdivided in 1833, it's really not until after annexation that it really takes off as the 7th municipal district of the city of New Orleans.
And, of course, the story begins with land belonging to Bienville, but let's go forward and talk a little bit about William Carroll, for whom Carrollton is named.
Well, Carroll came down to New Orleans to assist Andrew Jackson during the Battle of New Orleans. Both he and General Coffee came down, and they encamped on what was at the time frame the McCarthy Plantation before they went further on down to Chalmette to help defend the city of New Orleans. And according to some accounts in the 1870s, the town of Carrollton was in fact named after General Carroll because of his encampment in the area. He'll be a very important figure in the history of Tennessee.
Now, Carrollton was a separate entity for really 40 years. It was a village starting in 1833, then a town in 1845, then a city in 1859, and then it was annexed into New Orleans. But it packed a lot into those brief time periods.
Yes, it did. Like all municipalities, they had their municipal functions of schools, cemeteries, levees, markets. The courthouse for Jefferson Parish was also located there. They had their prison, their town hall. They had all the basic functions that a city would have, and there was a lot of economy going in that. It was highly relying on tourism, mostly people from New Orleans who want to get out of the city, took the train on out to Carrollton, and would go to the Carrollton Gardens or the Carrollton Hotel there. Many of the initial settlers of Carrollton were Germans, and so there was a lot of German beer gardens in Carrollton, so they had a good time in Carrollton.
Well, I was really intrigued by the Carrollton Gardens because those old pleasure gardens of the city, they just seem to have such a rich history.
Got to remember, we talk often about the good old days, but they weren't good. They were just old. Cities were not the best places to be, and Mark Twain said he was so grateful that it rained in New Orleans. It was like flushing the toilet. All of the animal species, the human waste and all, was flushed back to the swamps. So you had a lot of extension cities. You had, you know, there's no garbage pickup. The cities are not very sanitary. So by getting out to these urban gardens, if you will, because this is suburban, if you want to call it that, you could get away to some fresher air and to some nicer places. The one in Carrollton was based on one in New York City. So these were done nationwide.
And then, of course, in New Orleans and in Carrollton, we love our hotels. And there were two Carrollton hotels, weren't there?
Yes. The first one of 1840 was destroyed by fire, and then it was replaced by another hotel, very similar in appearance. But it almost looked like a Louisiana country home with a veranda wrapping all the way around it. For our climate, it was quite nice because it sheltered the sun from getting into the building. You could take advantage of the breezes. Back then, you'd get a good breeze from the river on towards Lake Pontchartrain. There was not a whole lot obstructing those breezes there. And you get a nice view of the Mississippi River from up there. So these were very pleasurable spots. They were known for their cuisine there. There was always entertainment going on in the hotels and in association with the gardens next door there. So this was, you know, you wanted to get out of town. You went out. It would be almost like going to the Mississippi coast today for New Orleanians. You kind of got out of the city, and you went to the suburbs to enjoy the fresh air.
Well, I love that you devote so much space to entertainment. And I wonder if you'd tell the story of Dan Rice and his traveling circus.
Dan Rice was a quite colorful figure. He is the precedent for our Uncle Sam. He was a circus clown, and his costume is what is, in fact, the inspiration for John Nash's drawing of Uncle Sam. He was the first celebrity to appear in a New Orleans carnival parade. He appeared in the first crew of Rex Parade, and the term jumping on the bandwagon, the political term there, he was a sponsor of the only president from Louisiana, Zachary Taylor, and Zachary Taylor used to ride on his bandwagon with him dressed up like we call Uncle Sam today, and people would literally jump on the bandwagon in support of Zachary Taylor. So he's a very colorful figure. There are some books which describe him the most famous American you've never heard of, because most people haven't heard of him, but he was more widely known than Mark Twain during his period. He was very influential in American history, but he was in New Orleans, he was in Carrollton, and he's got a lot of ties with New Orleans.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Robbie Cangelosi, Jr., author of New Orleans Architecture, Volume 9, Carrollton. Now, the book is in three parts. There's an opening history, then a building index, and a selective architectural inventory. So tell us about the ways people have used these books.
Well, we followed the precedent for the previous two books, in which we have some sort of history. In this one, we took a more detailed history because it was a separate city, and I did cut it off at the time that Carrollton was annexed. I don't go into the development of neighborhoods and things like that after the annexation, such as Gertown and other names that we have, Black Pearl, Marleyville, that we give to the neighborhoods today. So I kind of cut it off at that point. I just needed a stopping point. The selective inventory, the third section in there, we ran complete building titles of all those properties. We checked directories, tax records, and everything to develop the history of it. Now, I do have a database which I had created from building permits published in local newspapers, at the city archives, from local architectural magazines, Architectural Artists Allies, and Building Review. And I created a database that has over 80,000 entries into it of buildings in New Orleans when they were built. Mm. In some cases, the middle section, that has more properties listed there than the end section, because I could locate when the building was built, who the owner or the architect or the builder was, and we just didn't want to throw away that information. We wanted to include it in case someone wanted information on their property that we did not do in in-depth title research. It takes a while going down to the archives and digging up these titles. And, of course, when you're dealing with Carrollton, at some point you got to jump the river and go to Gretna because the titles are in the Gretna courthouse. Orleans does have some transfers, but if you want to see the original, like the original building contract for the building of the Carrollton Courthouse, the old McDonough, then that contract is you got to go across the river to Gretna to see the original building contract that Henry Howard had developed over there.
Wow.
So we tried to make as much as possible, and we did include in the this is the first book to be full color. In the previous books, there was only a small section in the middle, which was generally notarial archives. Instead of doing that, we incorporated those throughout the history portion and in the portion in the back with the more detailed. And since we found all these wonderful photographs, we did include a section in there. It's sort of like a Carrollton family album in there of all the old photographs and so forth that we included in there. And as you mentioned, I mean, the one that really blew my mind was the ice on the Mississippi River. I cannot imagine icebergs floating down the Mississippi River. It's just mind-boggling to me. But there's the photograph in Carrollton with the ice flowing down the Mississippi River.
And I know that's what makes books like this so magical. I mean, to see your city and your place through these eyes, you know. Now, I'm curious about your work in a larger sense. You specialize in historic preservation. Your firm is one of the oldest in the city, named for Sam Wilson and Richard Koch. How do you see the next generation of preservationists coming along? You know, this book is part of that legacy as well.
Yes, I do teach at Tulane's graduate program in historic preservation, and actually some of my students did assist in this book in doing some of the research in the archives, and I had one that did an internship with me from the program. He's now in private practice with the firm, and he helped work on the book. So there are some younger people interested in preservation that are getting somewhat involved in doing this work. So I'm hopeful for future generations that we will have other people that want to preserve our heritage as much as older people like me want to do.
We've been speaking with Robbie Cangelosi, Jr., who created the text for New Orleans Architecture, Volume 9, Carrollton. The book has photographs by Neil Alexander. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Jason Strada joins us now. He's the executive director of Friends of the Cabildo. Jason, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell us a little bit about the history of this series.
This is the 50th anniversary of the first book, which was done on the Lower Garden District. Now this is the ninth book in the series. This is the first book in 23 years, but we're excited to have it out. Originally, it was started, like I said, the Lower Garden District, but it wasn't even called the Lower Garden District at the time. When the book was written, there was no designation of Lower Garden District. So, you know, it started off, was part of a period of time where people were talking about preservation and trying to find ways to preserve what was happening in the city at that time from an architectural perspective. And the book series came out of that, and it was a lot of devoted volunteers, and a lot of people spent a lot of time of their own time to make these books happen over the years.
And tell us a little bit about the work of the Friends of the Cabildo, the sorts of things they're doing now.
So the Friends were founded in 1956 as a support agency for the Louisiana State Museum. And today we have all different kinds of different things that we do for the museum on a daily, monthly, and yearly basis. We do daily French Quarter walking tours that we operate out of the 1850 House Museum Store, which is one of our largest fundraising activities throughout the year. We host the Second Thursday Lecture Series. That's a monthly lecture series. We have a concert series. We have a film series. A lot of that is currently postponed because of COVID, but we also have an annual symposium, and we have a couple different fundraisers. Like, we just had our Creole Christmas. We have a yearly home and garden tour, and we also have a yearly, what we call the Ghostly Gallivant Tour as well. So throughout the entire year, we're pretty much doing some form of support for the museum to raise money to give towards them. We also do, we have a lot of people that are interested in preservation. So we also do cultural, what we call them, cultural and neighborhood tours. So we have a Carrollton neighborhood tour that we currently do. We have, I think, 9 different other tours that we do: Bywater, Lower Garden District, Garden District. So we do a lot of different things within the city with all the different volunteers that we have doing different things that they enjoy taking part in.
And also, I have to say, if you know, these days when people are reluctant to get out, I've seen some of these tours on YouTube as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, we have taken a little bit of a break, but we do use a Vox whisper system so that people can socially distance on all their tours. And we do require a mask on the tours, but you have little headsets that you can put on and a guide only talking to a little microphone.
Do you have anything special planned for the publication of this book?
At some point, an outdoor kind of event with Robbie again talking about the book. And we do have the Carrollton neighborhood tours, which will come back in a couple weeks. But we're just excited that it's out there. We're excited that we've got the 9th book in the series, and we're excited for what happens next with the next couple of chapters, which are going to be on the French Quarter, which we don't know if it'll be 1 book or 2 books.
It's just amazing. The series has been in the works 50 years.
50 years. And just to think that the word Lower Garden District was not used until the publication of the first book of this series, it's kind of hard to fathom that, you know, something that's so natural for all of us as people who live in New Orleans to say Lower Garden District. You know, that's just kind of a neat part of the story of the series.
Great. Oh, well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Jason Strada, who's the executive director of Friends of the Cabildo. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Chris Champagne is a poet, playwright, satirist, and comic. He's a great, well, opinionator is a word that comes to mind. He's the author of the poetry collection, The Roach Opera, his best-selling Yat Dictionary, The Charming Guide Secret New Orleans, and now he's out with the most interesting league in the world, How the NFL Explains America. Hey, Chris Champagne, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, one thing I loved learning from this book was that your dad, Ed Champagne, was an NFL player, so you grew up with a lot of these stories.
Yeah, some of them, yeah. I injected him in a little bit. There are about 465 stories, I think, in the book, and I only have him in about 6 or 7 of them. Things that he had told me came to mind as I was doing that were related to other things.
Well, tell us about his career.
Well, he was at All-American LSU in the 40s, played with Y.E. Tittle and Steve Van Buren, who he later played against in the pros. And then he went to play with the Rams in 1947. He played for 4 years. He was a lineman. People always ask me what position he played. He played offensive line, and they ask me if he played defense or offense. And I say he played both, because in those days you had to play offense and defense. One of the stories in the book is mentions that he played in an NFL championship game in 1949 against the Eagles when he played 59 minutes, every minute of the game but one. I don't know what happened with the one, but... he played in Canada. They offered him more money to go to Canada, so he went to Canada where he played. He was all pro up there the year that he played, but he broke his neck in the first half of a game, and he played the rest of the game with the neck, broken neck. He didn't realize that his neck was broken until a couple of days later, and that was the end of his career.
And then he went on to the track.
Yes, he did. He was a race official for about 50 years all over the country. With great distinction, I might add, if I may say so.
Of course. That's one of the sweetest things in this book when you mention your dad. It's really nice.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Now, I didn't want to overdo it. You
know? No. Now, 413 pages. This is a big collection of great stories. And there are all kinds of tales here. Shocking stories of bad behavior, some really hilarious stories, and some just plain old mischief. So how did you gather all these?
Well, a lot of research, old magazines, newspaper.com, you know, looking at old newspaper clippings, online, of course, a lot. I was online almost every day, it seems, for 2 years, looking for stuff. And I'd find to connect things and using the search engines to try to find, like, put in, like, Bob Dylan's name with the NFL, expecting to find nothing, and something pops up incredible, things like that. And there were a few stories that I've been a fan all my life. I was on the radio with Ronnie Virgis for about 7.5 years, so we used to do this thing called the Pro Football Subjective. And I would try to find interesting little tidbits that were connected to NFL franchises that would go over on the air. And it was a comedy show, so I would try to find the crazier things that I could. thought it was a good idea for a book. So I just did a lot of research, basically. It was a lot of fun, I must say.
Now, one of the great things is that you show how the NFL explains America by really bringing together extremes in American life. And one of my favorite stories is about Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, and his life as a collector. I love your literary guide for me, but he has two literary references. He owns a very important piece of American literature.
Yes, he does. He owns the original manuscript of On the Road. He has the original script of the Monty Python Holy Grail as well. I don't know if that's what you were referring to, but he also got a letter from Hunter S. Thompson, who was a well-known football fan, who implored him not to draft Peyton Manning.
I know. He said he should get Ryan Leaf.
Right. He should get Ryan Leaf, and he would lend him the money when his movie came out with Johnny Depp, because he'd have some money.
I know. I loved Hunter Thompson offering to lend him money. And I guess we know how all this turned out. So.
Yeah, Black Crystal just show you think you know Jim Warwick, so you think you know, but you don't know.
Now tell us about Marvin Gaye trying out for the Detroit Lions. That was quite a story.
Well, that was kind of serendipitous, I guess you'd say. Lem Barney and Mel Farr were two of the star players for the Lions at that day, and Lem Barney was playing golf, and he had the day off before he practiced that afternoon, and he decided that he thought that Marvin Gaye might live around it because it was Detroit. So he asked somebody, and of course everybody knew where he lived because he was famous, so he just went and stopped and knocked on the door. It turned out Gaye was a big pro football fan, so he immediately recognized Barney and invited him in, and they chatted a while, and then Barney realized time was going on. He had to run to practice. He told Mel Farr he'd just been hanging out with Marvin Gaye, and he couldn't believe it. And then they got to be really good friends. And at some point, Gaye asked them if he could try out for the team. So they asked Joe Schmidt, who was the Hall of Fame coach of the Lions. He said no at first, and then he said yes. So then Gaye threw himself into a regimen to get himself ready to play pro football. And went on a diet, stopped drinking, you know, stopped doing drugs, got himself in shape. And they let him try out for the team, and he didn't make it, and he seemed to accept the fact that he just wasn't good enough. But that was kind of, I thought, a pretty cool story, actually.
And they stayed friends.
Yes, they did. In fact, he insisted that Farr and Barney back him up on one of his gold records, even though they couldn't sing particularly well. and he gave them both gold records.
And then I love finding out that Tom Hanks is a big fan of the Snake, Kenny Stabler.
Right. Kenny Stabler's daughters found out that Hanks was a fan of his because he had mentioned him when he was receiving some awards on stage because he uses Kenny Stabler's catchphrase, throw deep, when people ask him how, you know, for advice on their careers, you know, to go far, in other words. And so his daughters, when Stabler passed, sent Tom Pierce some memorabilia. He sent them a nice letter, and I have a story about the letter in the book. And also, Hanks decided that when the Raiders moved recently to Vegas this year, that he was not going to look at Raiders games for a couple of years because it kind of bent him out of the shape. Because he grew up in Oakland, around the Oakland area. That's why he's an Oakland fan.
And, of course, you've got some Saints stories in here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, there's some pretty good ones. In fact, I think the Saints chapter is one of the best chapters in the book because I have a chapter for each team, and it's the last team chapter. I do have a chapter after them called Overtime, which is things that from the past and of NFL history. But the Saints chapter, I think, is one of the best ones. There's some of the best stories. Some things are in there that some Saints fans may have not heard. Most diehard fans probably have heard most of them, but there are probably a few here and there. I think that most chapters are like that. Most diehard fans of any team will have heard some of these stories, but there are two, three, or four in each chapter, I think, that would be a surprise to almost any fan, I think.
You're very generous with referring people to websites and YouTube performances.
Well, yeah.
And
well, I wanted to acknowledge people who have done some, you know, done some work and came up with some of these stories. And I tried to put links here and there for people to look for themselves because there were some nice videos on that you can find.
Well, I looked up that Buffalo Bills fan,
uh-huh,
Ron Johnson, and I got to see him covered with mustard and ketchup, and it was really pretty hilarious. So.
Yeah, he's banned from the official stadium area now. He's so popular. I don't know why they don't want him, but the NFL's pretty persnickety about their brand, I guess. I don't know.
I guess so. So there you have it. You've got politics, civil rights, battles of the sexes, big American dreams. You got a lot of X-rated stories in here, truthfully.
Well a few. Yeah.
A few. They were fun. So maybe the NFL really does explain America, but it's the one place where Donald Trump didn't get a foothold.
That's true. There's stories about Mr. Trump, President Trump, President Obama, President Harry Truman. There's about four stories about JFK in the book. So there's a connection to our presidents in a lot of ways as well. And our governor is in there. Ex-governor Edwin Edwards is in there. There's a lot of people I know with mice in there.
Well, of course.
San Francisco 49ers, but I couldn't pass that one up.
Well, you packed a lot into 400 pages.
Yeah, it kept kind of growing, and I had to cut some things out, but believe it or not, but I did.
Good job, I have to say. Perfect reading for the Super Bowl since the Saints aren't in it. So
yeah, now the season's over, you can use this to as a bridge.
It's our consolation.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
We've been talking with Chris Champagne, whose new book is The Most Interesting League in the World, How the NFL Explains America. You can meet him at a socially distanced sidewalk book signing Saturday, February 6th from 2 to 4 at Blue Cypress Books. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Take care. All right. Take care. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Garden District Bookshop hosts a virtual happy hour with Elise Arden. She'll discuss her most recent book in the Casket Girls series, The Gates of Guinea, Friday, January 29th at 5. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.